You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Welcome to another edition of Opus Talks. I'm Humberto Juarez Rocha, and I'll be your host today. When it comes to decarbonizing an industry, I often think about one that directly employs 11.6 million people and literally puts people above the clouds, either through ridiculously short destinations or across various time zones. The one industry I'm talking about is aviation, and specifically one scheme that aims to decarbonize the industry. One that is at the intersection of both compliance and the VCM, the voluntary carbon market. And the scheme I'm talking about, and I'm trying to learn more about today, is CORSIA, or the Carbon Offsetting and Reduction Scheme for International Aviation. CORSIA is governed by the International Civil Aviation Organization, also known as ICAO, which is a specialized agency of the United Nations. The scheme essentially asks airlines to offset the growth in their carbon emissions above a certain baseline. And the scheme promotes different ways of offsetting this, whether it's through the purchase of carbon credits drawn from the VCM supply or investing in sustainable aviation fuels or others. According to ICAO, there are currently 130 countries participating under CORSIA, including the United States, among many other countries around the world. But, of course, the devil's in details, and it can get a bit complicated when we get down to it and what this actually looks like in practice. Just to get a larger sense of the picture, I want to go into how many emissions aviation is responsible for. So let's take a look at some numbers. According to the International Energy Agency, aviation accounted for 2.5% of energy-related CO2 emissions in 2023. That's equivalent to 950 million metric tons of CO2 in that year. And this was around 90% of pre-COVID-19 levels back before the pandemic, basically shut down flying for a couple of months. But for today's episode, I really want to welcome my colleague Henry Kronk, a senior reporter covering the VCM and who has written extensively about CORSIA. Henry, welcome to the podcast. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and your coverage?
Thanks, Humberto. Good to be with you today. I'm the senior markets editor at Opus, the lead editor for our Global Carbon Offset Report, which tracks a variety of different carbon credit types across the VCM. And in my role, I also occasionally report for Wall Street Journal Sustainable Business Pro. And that is largely what has led me to CORSIA over the past couple of years.
Awesome, Henry, and really, really nice to have you on. We've done a couple of reporting travels together and talking about aviation. I mean, could you just, to start off, could you tell us a bit of history about CORSIA and where it currently stands?
Yeah, absolutely. So the roots of CORSIA go back to the Kyoto Protocol. As a lot of people know, especially Europeans, the Kyoto Protocol was not by any means a perfect carbon market designed at all. One kind of deficiency that some folks identified was that while it covered domestic flights and emissions from airports, there is this whole swath of emissions that weren't being accounted for when airlines were flying between each other. So there was kind of talks about, okay, how do we bring this into a carbon market scheme through the 2000s and 2010s? And then CORSIA is formalized by ICAO in 2016. So it was broken down into three phases, essentially, when it was first designed. The first was a pilot phase covering the years 2021 through 2023. Phase one goes from 2024 to 2026. That's what we're in right now. And we are in this place essentially where we are eyeing down the market getting underway and functioning for the first time. And the reason for that is during the pilot phase, there is a lot of support internationally for it. But as you mentioned, during the COVID era, that really brought emissions down everywhere, including in international aviation. And per the rules of CORSIA, there was actually no compliance obligation for that pilot phase. So everything was kind of set up and ready to go. And then there was no emissions growth to offset. Mm-hmm. So we have now surpassed that. And there are emissions to offset. And everybody's really working hard, looking around, doing a lot of due diligence to essentially get it off the ground, no pun intended.
Interesting thing. And thank you, Henry. It seems like we're nearing the end of phase one. And I'm really curious, as someone who has engaged in the carbon market, perhaps more on the compliance side, but CORSIA is so interesting. It seems to be, again, there's many countries in it. It draws from the VCM supply, but I'm curious as to how CORSIA actually works. If I'm an airline, what should I be thinking about as we are nearing the end of phase one? How can I be preparing for phase two, which starts next year?
Yeah, so just very generally, the scheme works, ICAO has said, any of the international airlines sector's emissions growth above 85% of what it emitted in 2019, that has to be offset. So how does that work? You can, as an airline, you can try and get below that level, below 85% of what the sector emitted in 2019 by using sustainable aviation fuel. Sounds great. Unfortunately, SAF accounted for less than 1% of all jet fuel production, I believe, last year. I think it doubled from 2024 to 2026 from about 0.3% to 0.6% or something like that. It's really not moving the needle very much right now. Certainly that will theoretically change, hopefully change in the future. So that leaves us essentially looking at the offsetting component to maintain compliance. So how are you going to offset? It's really interesting. This, unlike kind of other UN carbon markets, this market exclusively draws credits from the voluntary carbon market. And ICAO has set a few different eligibility requirements. First, it has approved a select group of registries. So these are organizations that approve methodologies, review the validation and verification of carbon projects, then issue credits, and then also track their retirements, among many other things that registries do. Beyond that, ICAO has said, actually, we don't want to accept all credits issued from these registries. In some cases they do, but they've also set further criteria for what they'll allow. So for example, Red Plus at the project level is not accepted under ICAO. It is accepted for a jurisdictional Red Plus. There are many other kind of minutiae in what they allow, but essentially there is a subset of all the volume issued in the voluntary carbon market that airlines can draw from to offset their emissions. Now, on top of that, maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but for phase one, ICAO has also been conscious that a separate UN organization or UN body, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, is underway with the Paris Agreement, which is a much broader, wide-reaching global agreement. And they essentially don't want to step on each other's toes. So what they have said is the Paris Agreement has put in place this mechanism to avoid double counting credits, which is very common in the carbon market. You don't want a situation where two different entities are retiring the same carbon credit and claiming its benefits. Mm-hmm. So the way that they do that is for a credit to be eligible under CORSIA Phase 1, the host country of the project that has issued the credit needs to say, I'm going to authorize this credit for international transfer, meaning I, as a country, am not going to claim it. Mm-hmm. elsewhere in the voluntary carbon market, if a project is located in your jurisdiction, you can factor that into your carbon inventory and say, this has been claimed by us, you know, because essentially you are asking not only your country, but also the businesses that operate within them to lower emissions, the citizens that live within your borders to offset emissions. So kind of all of that is kismet, you know, but we get into an issue if a country is trying to say this is part of our emissions reduction, but a different airline is also claiming that for its international airfare. So you were asking, what should I be doing if I'm an airline? The short answer is you should be educating yourself and paying as close attention as possible to this space. It's another kind of compliance mechanism that you have to deal with in addition to several other things. And it's going to eat into your margins, which are quite slim in the aviation industry in general. We're going to get into this further, but there is really just not a clear playbook right now for CFOs of airlines. I mean, the more we talk about this, I keep trying to avoid aviation sayings and puns, but really it is up in the air. It is undecided right now what the way forward is.
Let's see if we can keep those up. I'll keep some in mind as well. But Henry, no, it's fascinating what you say, because I mean, when you mention the sustainable aviation fuel accounts for less than 1%, so it sounds like there might be more pressure on purchasing these types of offsets. And then you're telling me that these, you know, some credits have to be allocated towards ICAO and the other ones account for a country's national determined contribution. So they can't be double counted. They're very separate. But I'm thinking ahead and I'm curious, Henry, as we look at phase two, do airlines currently have to buy any of these credits now? And does that change in phase two? How are you seeing the supply of ICAO certified or credits for CORSIA and ICAO and the supply and demand dynamics of this scheme? How are you seeing that as we come into the last year of phase one?
Yeah, totally. So at this point, we know the sector's emissions growth rate for 2024, and we've got a pretty good idea for 2025. And based on that, there is some pretty credible estimates of what total demand is going to be. It's looking like at the very, very, very low end, it's still going to be about 100 million credits, maybe a little bit less. At the high end, it's going to be well over 200 million credits. So that's kind of a pretty broad range, but we're talking about quite a large volume. And keep in mind, the voluntary carbon market, depending on which registries you look at, there are many small registries that operate. But of the main ones, there has been about 150 million retirements to about 165 million retirements per year over the past couple of years. So we're essentially looking at an extra year of VCM demand from this scheme. So that's quite substantial. That's quite material. Honestly, I haven't even paid very much attention to phase two. There are people who are looking out that far. But the main headline here is we're going to go back to the Paris Agreement rules that I was talking about, where countries need to authorize credits. There have only been, as of today, there's roughly a little under 50 million credits that have been authorized for international transfer. There's not really a risk that there aren't enough credits that have been issued in the VCM that are eligible for transfer. The main barrier is that countries are realizing that for every credit I authorize for international transfer, that is another ton of emissions that I need to mitigate somehow within my own borders. If you, going back to the Paris Agreement, you mentioned nationally determined contributions earlier, which are essentially the Paris Agreement, you know, a country's emissions reduction targets, similar to how a company will say, we want to be net zero by 2050, or we want to reduce emissions by 2035. Mm-hmm. Countries have been encouraged to be more and more ambitious in setting their targets. And there, a lot of countries have kind of taken that challenge and run with it to their credit, some much more than others. But a lot of countries have in the past year woken up to the fact that, okay, I want to be ambitious with my target. I want to say we're going to reduce emissions as much as we can. On the other hand, there is this financial incentive if I authorize credits for transfer. A lot of countries aren't just giving these away for free. You know, they are saying, okay, well, one, I want businesses operating within my borders to succeed, you know, and CORSIA grade credit is going to trade quite a bit higher than something that is not CORSIA grade. And a lot of these authorizations have also been structured to deliver a fee per credit to the host country. Some have said, okay, you can transfer this, and I've got the option to either take it and use it for my NDC myself and or trade. So this is kind of a big potential revenue source for countries that they need to balance with the targets that they have set. Mm-hmm. So a lot of countries are realizing that it's actually quite difficult to strike that balance. There are a lot of unknowns here, and there is a very real question as to whether countries will authorize enough credits to satisfy total demand for phase one. And let me also just add that phase one runs from 2024 to 2026, but compliance is due in January of 2028. We've got a little bit under 2 years right now. So that is essentially where we are with supply and demand. We've got a good idea of demand, and there are some other factors that we're going to talk about later that could influence that, but supply is a bit of a question mark still.
Sounds like you're telling us to brace for a little bit of turbulence in this market, but it's actually fascinating to hear, you know, what the dynamics are. I mean, it sounds like you have a good sense of what demand is, supply. You know, when we look at countries' carbon budget, you know, their NDCs. I'm actually curious, Henry, I think I read one of your stories about different price points you're seeing. And I'm curious, from what you're saying, it sounds like maybe if I'm a country that generates, where a lot of carbon credits are generated, I might make more money if I sell them as CORSIA approved credits. But also, I'm curious, what price points have you seen in the market so far as it's developing? Can you tell us a bit more about what prices you're seeing?
Yeah, very good question. Let's talk Turkey here. So credits tend to be valued in many different ways for many, many different reasons. One, you could just look at the type of credit. What kind of project is it coming from? What methodology is it following? A big source of supply so far has been clean cookstove. So these are projects that will distribute clean cooking devices to regions where they traditionally cook over charcoal burning fires indoors. And there's a range of quality among cookstove credits. They could trade anywhere from, you know, a very low quality project might trade under a dollar to, if you get a very good price, maybe 10, kind of upward barrier, maybe a little bit higher for something that just has a lot of quality measures in place. Mm-hmm. CORSIA credits have traded up until the end of last year. There were kind of no trades for CORSIA credits below about 18, and some were trading up to 2350, I believe is the highest price that I've heard. Well, Guyana is a big source of CORSIA credits, and on the 19th, a climate official in the country said that they had been trading at prices higher than previous deals that they've signed in a previous deal that they had signed with the oil and gas producer Hess. Is currently delivering credits at $20 a metric ton.
Wow.
So It's a big range. Since the beginning of the year, I should say. There are a few futures contracts delivering CORSIA credits, and those prices have come way down. They've come down from $19.50 to $20 all the way down to $12.50 yesterday on the 19th. So that's a bit of a different discussion, but I would say that that price decline doesn't necessarily speak to basic supply and demand dynamics. It kind of factors in other things, other factors that we can talk about. But essentially, you can be looking at a premium of easily $15 if you can take this credit and get authorization to trade it for CORSIA eligibility.
No, I definitely hear you now on, you know, if I'm a country where these credits are being generated, I mean, I definitely will have a bit of a trade-off if I want to sell them as CORSIA or keep them within my carbon budget. I'm really curious as to how this plays out, the different dynamics to it. And as you well mentioned, I think we were both in Baku when the parties agreed to this Paris Agreement crediting mechanism. So really excited to see how this works out. But and Henry, now I kind of want to zoom out a little bit, actually. And I mean, CORSIA is actually a really interesting example of a multilateral effort that, you know, where we have 130 countries involved, including the US. However, and I do ask this coming from someone who covered the carbon market for a long time and emissions regulation, but we are living in an era right now where the US under President Donald Trump is tearing up multilateral agreements, pulling out of international collaboration. I mean, CORSIA is a very interesting case. Like, where is CORSIA amidst this context of the US pulling out of these types of agreements? How is it standing? I mean, the US is still a party, as I understand it.
Yeah, totally. So Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement for the second time. And beyond that, he's left the UNFCCC, the treaty convention that put the Paris Agreement in place. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty safe to say that the United States isn't going to pull out of ICAO anytime soon. This is a pretty crucial international body that sets things like safety standards in airplanes, standards for air traffic controllers, fuel standards, you know. So unless Trump wants literally no Americans leaving the country by plane and nobody else coming in, you know, I mean, let's not put anything off the table, really. But, you know, that's kind of a pretty radical eventuality. Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't mean that Trump couldn't pull out of CORSIA and remain in ICAO. But, and you would think, right, like pulling out of ICAO, that's catnip for MAGA. You know, Trump's Department of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has essentially said this when addressing the ICAO council session last year. This body is spending all this money on environmental measures when we should be focusing on air safety and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there are unfortunately some complicating factors for, you know, for doing that. The first is that let's talk about the EU emissions trading system first. Mm-hmm. So in the ETS, flights within the European Economic Area, mm-hmm. those are covered under the ETS and those are exempted from CORSIA. Mm-hmm. The EU, when it originally designed its ETS, was saying, and we should include international flights too. Then ICAO came along with CORSIA and they said, okay, you know what? We're all about the spirit of multilateralism. Just like ICAO doesn't want to step on the toe of the Paris Agreement, we don't want to step on the toe of CORSIA. Mm-hmm. So we're going to exempt international aviation from our ETS for now. And they've kind of said, okay, it's exempt for this amount of years. They've done that a couple times. And that is coming up for review that they are due to reconsider that during their review of the ETS, which is needs to happen by the end of June this year. Mm-hmm. Should the EU perceive that actually CORSIA isn't really working, there is a very strong chance that they could say, okay, we're ending our exemption for international aviation. And if you fly to Europe, you don't have to pay the CORSIA price of, you know, we're calling the CEO mean at 1750 around right now. Mm-hmm. You've got to pay an ETS price, which is, I don't follow it as closely, but quite multiples more expensive. On top of that, the UK could do the same thing. Switzerland could do the same thing. Other countries that are considering or developing emissions trading systems around the world could do the same thing. And suddenly, if you work at the compliance department of American Airlines, your staff needs to double or triple in size just to keep track of all these ETSs around the world. So airlines based in America who fly to other countries very much want CORSIA to work, because that means that they only have to deal with one scheme. And not only that, it's going to be cheaper than other schemes around the world, unless, I mean, the EU ETS is quite dynamic right now as well, but probably it's going to be quite a bit cheaper. So there is a clear American business interest to remain in CORSIA. At the same time, there's a clear ideological interest in the Trump administration to pull out. What's going to happen? Nobody knows. I believe, you know, we don't always get to do very exciting reporting in these very nitty-gritty markets, but I believe my reporting features some of the first and only official statements a Trump administration official has said about CORSIA. And what did they say? We are still considering our participation in CORSIA. We think environmental schemes like this are costly and dumb for consumers, but we're still considering, essentially, is what they said.
It's really, really interesting. I mean, as you laid out, you know, the American business interest in dealing with one compliance obligation as opposed to dealing with multiple different priced. I mean, that's something we already hear in different markets. But in aviation specifically, I think it's so fascinating, especially when you think about when the U.S. and the tactics that it used to prevent the passage of a carbon price on the International Maritime Organization last year. So hearing this is really cool. And Henry, your reporting on this has been really exciting to hear about. You don't hear much about CORSIA, but to hear that there is to report on the American business interest, the business incentives, and the incentives, again, to not have something be so fragmented. It's fascinating. And I'm looking forward to reading your future stories on the Wall Street Journal at Opus. And Henry, just kind of as we near the end of the podcast, it's been really, really enlightening to hear about all the different dynamics, but also the voluntary carbon market as well. I mean, when we joined a couple of years ago, in the year since, it kind of underwent a bit of a substantial transformation due to scrutiny from reporting about credits and their value. Has this affected CORSIA, or how has that played out for CORSIA?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So just very quickly, without going into too much detail, you know, there has been this kind of, it was kind of a poorly kept secret within the industry before. And then there was some major reporting on this at the end of 2022, beginning of 2023. A lot of these methodologies that these projects are following don't do a good job of ensuring that when a project receives a credit, it represents one metric ton of reduced or removed emissions. And some projects do a lot better, some do a lot worse. There have been ratings agencies that have popped up to essentially rate how the quote-unquote integrity of a carbon project. ICAO is not a ratings agency. They are this international body that has been tasked with implementing this market based on the rules that they collectively agreed in 2016. One of the kind of ironic things about CORSIA is that the credits that are eligible under their criteria are not necessarily the highest quality. Certainly, there have been some moves to say, okay, we want to use only kind of the newer methodologies. But if we go back to 2025, they actually, if we're looking at cookstoves, you know, they had originally said we're going to go for this one newer, higher quality methodology. And then they realized this supply shortfall was very real and challenged the success of the market. So they went back and said, actually, this older methodology that is kind of has, you can interpret it a little in, with more flexibility, we're going to incorporate that as well. So where does that leave buyers? Buyers now are in this place where they're going to have to buy credits. Those credits might not be very high quality. And some of the biggest kind of greenwashing, I mean, Delta faced the first kind of really big greenwashing backlash for the carbon credits that it was buying. If you read some of these airlines' SEC filings and 10K reports under the risk section, they said, there are all these risks about how CORSIA is going to work. It's going to increase prices for us. But there's also this risk that we're going to face greenwashing claims just by complying with this thing that we need to comply with. Theoretically, under a compliance system, it should be just the cheapest to deliver credit is what you buy. You know, that's how somebody acting in their fiduciary duty would operate. Have we seen airlines buying credits with an eye towards credit quality yet? Not necessarily. If you look at some airlines' kind of broader decarbonization goals outside of CORSIA, you do see some British Airways, you know, for example, is buying durable carbon dioxide removal from engineered projects, which are much more expensive and considered a much, much less exposed to greenwashing risk. Mm-hmm. But while supply remains so constrained, there isn't a lot of room for CFOs to operate in there. There's very little wiggle room. I don't mean to say that all CORSIA eligible credits are poor quality. There are some very high quality credits out there. Mm-hmm. However, right now, if we just kind of bring it all together, like there is this possibility that the US leaves CORSIA. There's also this possibility that even though the US has left, the EU says we're continuing our exemption for international aviation, CORSIA is going to go ahead. Under that scenario, supply would be a lot looser. The US airlines account for about 30%, probably give or take a little bit of demand for this scheme. So if US airlines are out, that, you know, airlines around the world are going to essentially breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. But if supply does remain tight, CFOs have a real Gordian knot to untie on their hands.
Wow, Henry, this has been a really, really enlightening conversation, learning about all these dynamics. I'm really excited to see what comes out of the review of the EU ETS, the US and ICAO, the supply constraints of this market, but also, and maybe we can talk about this in a different podcast, but airlines looking at different types of credits, especially the ones that are engineered-based as opposed to nature-based. So I'd love to touch more on that with you next time, but I just want to thank you for your time, for your reporting, and again, keep us updated as we see this market evolve, pricing included, and thank you again, Henry, for being on the podcast with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.